I didn't mean to say thank me for this. Please, everybody, thank me.
It's a wonderful day.
It is. Good evening and welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. Our guest this evening is Micah Greenstein, Senior Rabbi at Temple Israel in Memphis. Micah has served Temple Israel for 26 years, 16 of those years as its senior rabbi. He has been named as one of the city's most significant leaders and was recognized as the first Memphian of the Year by Memphis Magazine in 2013. Throughout the 10-year of his career, he has received countless awards, but he has most recently been honored with the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Be the Dream Legacy Award in 2016. I'm so grateful to have Rabbi Greenstein here with us tonight, especially on this holy day of Yom HaShoah. And tonight we will reflect on the importance of this day, particularly as it relates to our current political and social climate, as well as the presence of rising anti-Semitism in Europe and America. I'm Meredith Day, Minister of Youth and faculty member at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. Hi, Micah.
Wow.
Oh, Micah, it's such a gift to be with you.
To be with you, Meredith.
Wow.
And this crowd.
I know, this ginormous crew of people. It's wonderful. Well, before we get started into the kind of meat of our conversation tonight, I want to first ask you if you'll just tell us a little bit more about yourself and sort of what life looks like for you these days in Memphis.
Well, I always say that every day is a slice of heaven. Some days are thicker than others. You know, we Jews, we have the Sabbath on Friday and Saturday, but thanks to you, we also have Sunday school. But I'm very hopeful about our city because of religious leaders like you and the youth group in the crowd.
Hmm. Wonderful. Awesome. And what have you been up to right now in Memphis? I know you worked with MLK 50.
Yeah, that has consumed me in a very rich and meaningful way. It exceeded everything I could have imagined in scope and import to have the world come to Memphis and draw its inspiration from the National Civil Rights Museum. It really is taken for granted in the city how Memphis is the Jerusalem of civil rights. And it was an emotional, meaningful, not just April 4th, but the entire week. So we deserve to feel proud of what we're doing to move from whether your theology is crucifixion to resurrection, or from despair to hope,
right.
Where Passover really is where we've been, from slavery to freedom, darkness to light.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, tonight, again, as I mentioned, we're meeting here, which I believe is the closing evening, right, of Yom HaShoah.
Right.
It started yesterday evening.
That's right.
Is that right? And then it finishes tonight at sundown, I think. And I learned recently, I've been researching in preparation for our time together, that this day also marks the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943. So I wonder if you will just tell us a little bit more about Yom HaShoah and the ways in which, you know, Jewish communities celebrate this holiday, and also about the revolt in Warsaw.
Sure. So we all know the biblical holidays. There are some modern holidays and commemorations. This is one of them. This holiday, Holocaust Remembrance Day, was established by the parliament, the Knesset, in the State of Israel in 1953. One out of every 4 to 6 original Israelis were survivors of the Holocaust. So the post-traumatic shock of what happened. And it's actually called Yom HaZikaron LaShoah VeLaGvura, which means remembrance of the day of the Holocaust and the heroism of our people who perished in Nazi Europe. And so the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was viewed as the resistance. But there's been a a re-evaluation of what resistance means. Is it just physical resistance? What about the mother who held her child and calmed her child down before they were both murdered instead of running to the Nazi with the machine gun and abandoning their child? So there are all types of resistance. In Israel, unlike America, where we've lost a sense, Memorial Day, maybe there are flags in your yard, but no one honors it with a moment of silence. And in Israel, as we were talking, Meredith, they, literally at 10 o'clock in the morning, sirens go off, and if you're on the highway, you stop your car. The whole country stops to remember for 2 minutes. And who was it, Santayana, who said, those who cannot remember the past are doomed
to repeat it, yeah.
Right? And so in Israel and throughout the Jewish world, we remember. Most of the survivors of the Holocaust are dying by the day. There are only about 20,000 left. And I think everyone would agree, no matter what your path to God, that you need to know where you've come from to know where you're going. In the Bible, the word for ancient times is the same word for moving forward. It's the same three-letter biblical Hebrew root, kedem kadima. And in our country, we would do well to remember what's happened in history, that 66% of millennials don't even know what Auschwitz is, and 22% don't even know what the Holocaust was. So I guess I'd close this part of our talk by saying something somewhat provocative, and that is the Holocaust has nothing to do with Judaism. It was an attack on the message of Judaism of one God, one humanity. Just as racism isn't a black problem, rape is not a woman's problem, anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem, but since these are our relatives who died, we honor them by lighting candles and having commemorations. In fact, right now at the Jewish Community Center, children of survivors and grandchildren will be lighting candles in remembrance of those who died.
Wow, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Sure.
And up next, a very simple question.
Sure.
I mentioned to you, right, was talk with us about the Jewish theology or theologies of evil and suffering. So just really simple question for you.
Why is the sky blue?
That's right. I mean, how do different communities, how do they, you know, particularly in light of this remembrance, how do they make sense of something that makes no sense?
Sure. Well, people asked the question, where was God during the Holocaust? But a better question is, where was man? Where was humanity? Elie Wiesel, the moral conscience, the poet of the Holocaust, tells the story of when the Nazis made everyone come out, and they would do this often, and witness the hanging of children. And someone whispered in Elie Wiesel's ear, you know, where is God? And he said, he's hanging on the gallows. So what I love about your podcast is it forces us to think about our theology. And one of my teachers, famous Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, whose wife's family survived the Holocaust, made the statement, no matter what your faith, after the Holocaust, no theological statement should ever be made that can't be true in the presence of burning children. So when people talk about eternal verities like grace and love, and well, let's talk about, as you said, evil. I believe that God weeps with us, not against us, that if God is like a great mother or father or friend, no God with those attributes would ever will the innocent death of anyone. So there are people who went into the Holocaust with faith and came out with faith. There are people who went in with no faith and came out with no faith. There are people who really struggle with God after what they experienced. But I think in the end, if we're God's helping hands, then our task in this lifetime is to heal the hurt and to alleviate the suffering, and also to condemn evil, right? I think one of the lessons of the Holocaust is that neutrality is a cop-out, that not to decide is also to decide that, you know, when it comes to matters of honesty and goodness, when those are involved in the face of evil, there's no such thing as being neutral. And then when you ask also about evil and suffering, another might be that pacifism is impossible. You know, we learned from the Holocaust, from Auschwitz, that not that war is wrong always, it usually almost always is, but in the face of Hitler, it's not that killing is wrong, but killing innocent people is wrong. You know, we have, I was love the sinner and hate the sin, but that applies to religious transgressions, not cruelty. So those who loved Hitler were not likely to fight him. And I'm not sure whether religious people have taken evil seriously enough after the Holocaust. I mean, I tend to be toward more like a pacifist, but what I'm saying is nonviolence worked for Gandhi when your enemies are the British. But when your enemies are not just white supremacists, but Aryan, racial, driven destroyers who believed in the annihilation of a people, that has to be stopped. So evil and suffering in all its dimensions is evoked by this day of Holocaust Remembrance Day. And that's just off the top of my head. I'm sure there are other facets. Do you have anything on your mind that? Or?
Well, I'm thinking specifically, I wonder, like, what are, in relation to evil and suffering, you know, how are different facets kind of coming to terms with that of Judaism? Like, you're at a Reform synagogue,
right?
Correct? How does that run the gamut with these different Jewish communities and groups that make sense of that?
Well, what's that expression, same tribe, different teepee? So if you're Episcopalian or Methodist, you're still a Christian.
Right.
So, you know, there are many, God must have a great sense of humor, look at us,
sure.
Right? And there are many strange animals, there are many strange animals in the zoo, right, of humanity.
Right.
So in the Jewish world, you know, we have country cousins who we may not agree with on everything.
Sure. I'm stealing that phrase, country cousins.
But the main theme, but I think the main themes of this Holocaust Remembrance Day when it comes to evil are that we have to teach others to prevent this evil from happening again. And we must always remember never to forget those who perished. The thing about genocide is that the slogan of the Holocaust after it ended, one out of every three Jews in the world was murdered. Hitler's goal was for me not to be here. So 2/3 of the Jewish world survived. We said never again. And then it happened again in Cambodia.
Right.
It happened again in Rwanda. When the Holocaust Museum was being dedicated in Washington, D.C., Elie Wiesel turned to President Clinton and said, we say never again. And right now, Bosnian women are being raped and a genocide is being perpetrated, and we're not doing anything. So I think the Holocaust is a lens to and a call for action.
Right.
To and it explains, I think, the reason for our country, good over evil, right over wrong, and to stand up and speak out. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. Is there, devotionally, is there any sort of prayer or mantra, particularly during this holiday of Yom HaShoah, that you kind of carry close to you, or even more broadly in these conversations about being an ally and standing up for what's right?
So this is only a 65-year-old holiday, unlike the ones that are 4,000 years old. So there are a lot of rituals that have been written about Yom HaShoah. typically candles, I mentioned one for each of the 6 million, Poetry of the Children, The Last Butterfly, written by the children of the Theresienstadt ghetto, and survivors. There's usually testimony. There are some verses that are read from scripture. Not that it is expected in a formal way to read the liturgy that we would do at a normal holiday or Sabbath service, but like when Jeremiah says, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from shedding tears, there is hope for your future. It usually ends with the Israeli national anthem, which is the hope, which flips the valley of dry bones on its head in Ezekiel. You know, he said, our hope is lost, and the Israeli national anthem says, our hope is not yet lost. It's a very emotional service, typically with music and memory, often a guest speaker in Memphis today, the head of Facing History and Ourselves. And this is interesting. There are a lot of interfaith commemorations. One of the most moving experiences I ever had was at Calvary Episcopal Church about 15 years ago. I was asked to come to a Yom HaShoah service, and I'm like, at the JCC, they said, no, at Calvary Episcopal. And I remember, Meredith, thinking anti-Semitism was the fatal flaw in Christianity's long and noble attempt to serve God. Jesus, the Jew, who was crucified by the Romans, as the Romans crucified thousands of Jews, was turned into Jesus, the Christian, murdered by Jews. Yeah. And for 1900 years, that was the case. And I remember being in that beautiful sanctuary thinking, we're living in miraculous times. I mean, this is a podcast sponsored by another Episcopal church, which is amazing. So I would say what we ought to do on this day, in addition to remembering, is to raise up examples of goodness, righteous Gentiles who saved not just Jews, but gypsies and gays. They weren't necessarily religious people. It's an interesting, I wrote an article on righteous Gentiles during the Holocaust. Some of them were atheists, but they felt that saving children should be as natural as breathing. So there is no fixed liturgy, but that makes more possibilities available.
I'm Meredith Day, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with Rabbi and public theologian Micah Greenstein. Tonight, we are discussing the observance of Yom HaShoah, a day of remembrance commemorating the lives of the 6 million Jews who were murdered in the Holocaust during World War II. Again, you've kind of already alluded to this, Micah, but unfortunately, even as we celebrate this holiday or we remember this holiday, we are faced with, we're bumping up against anti-Semitism rising in both Europe and America. Why do you think that is?
Flannery, the great Catholic theologian who wrote a classic book called The Anguish of the Jews, calls anti-Semitism the longest running hatred in the history of humanity. What's so irrational about hate is that it's completely irrational, right? We try to explain it. There are places in the world where there are no Jews, but the stereotype of the Jew becomes a lightning rod for anti-Semitism. For instance, in Japan, there was a series, there's the old blood libel that Jews would use the blood of children to make their Passover cakes, which is antithetical to Jewish teaching, the whole message of Passover. We don't believe in blood atonement. We have, you know, we were slaves, so we have, yeah, we have, you know, the flat cracker, because when we were slaves, the dough didn't have enough time to rise. We had to run away from our slave masters. So why am I telling you that? Because on network TV in a lot of the Muslim world, there are these TV shows that show the Jew as Hitler did. See, Hitler was diabolical, but fused this hatred of the Jew with a racial eugenics approach that said, Jews are not a faith family, which is what we are. I mean, if you go to Israel, you see Jews from 103 different nationalities. You see black Jews, Asian Jews, Swedish Jews, Argentinian Jews, European Jews. But he convinced the world that it's in their blood. So like vermin, you need to eradicate them. And so that toxic kind of hate, once it's let out, like Protocols of the Elders of Zion, it's a fictitious account of a group of Jews meeting to take over the world. It's been translated into 30 languages, and people believe it. They believe that it's real. I think one of the reasons is there are not that many Jews. So it's easy to exaggerate. So in Germany, Jews were less than 0.5%. Like if I ask people here in the crowd, what percent of Memphis do you think are Jews out of 1 million people? I've heard people say, well, probably about 10%. You know, I've seen names like Goldsmith, you know, the Gardens, or in the philanthropy community with MIFA and all the great work. So there must be a ton of Jews here. Well, there are only about 8,500 or 9,000 Jews out of over 1 million people in the Mid-South. It's less than 1%. And here, by the way, we're all brothers and sisters, but you can imagine in a country that wants a scapegoat, and they're not that many. I got pulled over by a cop when I was the student rabbi in Jonesboro, Arkansas. I flew into Memphis. They allowed me to bring my wife for one holiday. It's our holiest day of the year, so we go over by that Southland.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, blue lights pull me over. My wife leans over and said, he wasn't going that fast. He looks at me, said, get out of the car. Get in my car. First, he asked me if she was my wife. If she wasn't my wife, I don't know what he would have done. And then he said, first of all, during this mile stretch, you were going 62 in a 50, and it's not 55. For this half mile, it was 45. Secondly, you don't talk back to an Arkansas State Trooper. I said, yes, sir. He said, so where are you going? I said, Jonesboro. And he said, why are you going there? I said, because I'm a rabbi. He said, what's a rabbi? I said, a Jewish minister. So he takes his shades off. This is like early September. We're still like 100 degrees here. And he leans over and he looks at me and he says, never met a Jew before. He said, so why are you going to Jonesboro? Rabbi? I said, well, tonight is Yom Kippur. And I'm thinking to myself, you idiot. The guy's never met a Jew. Now you're throwing Hebrew out at him. So I said, it's our Day of Atonement. It's like our Easter. It's like, it's a big Jew holiday. I see the gun in this holster. I'm waiting for him to use it. And my wife is probably wondering, like, what is going on? And I said, I'm going there for our fall Jewish holiday, sir. It's like our big, big holiday. Seemed like an eternity went by. Hey, wait a minute. Did Sandy Koufax not pitch a baseball game on one of these Jew holidays? I'm like, tonight. Tonight was the night Sandy Koufax wouldn't pitch. So he starts talking about baseball, and he said, this may never happen again, but, you know, have a good kipper. And he let me go. So I wrote Sandy Koufax, who was in Boise, Idaho at the time, and I said, you not only, I reached him through one of my seminary professors, and I said, you not only saved me 50 points on my license and a $100 fine, you saved my life. But my point is that I think ignorance in America is greater than anti-Semitism, but in Europe, it's viral. In France, you probably read this week, a Holocaust survivor was killed. You can't well, you know, when you think about Selma, like the kids in Selma had to go to school with National Guards, probably dozens of them. In France, I'm told, if you were a yarmulke, like one of these when I pray, if you wore this out and to a Jewish school, you need hundreds of police protecting you. So that's what's so sad and tragic. The defacing of Jewish graves, the eradication of memory in Poland. They even were passing a bill which says that Poland wasn't complicit in the Holocaust, that it was the Nazis, even though there were willing executioners among the masses. Because I don't blame Hitler. I blame the people who followed him, right? And we ignore the signs. People just say, oh, people are crazy. They say crazy things. You know, Charlottesville, people said it was awful. It was a blip. But all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing, right? And I think that's what's happening in a lot of Europe. Hopefully it'll change. In fairness to like Angela Merkel of Germany, there is memory there. We have had 26 lynchings in Shelby County, and we're trying to mark them all. In Berlin, you can't walk without hitting what they call stepping stones. They're in front of all the residences or industry buildings where Jews and others were deported. So it would say, like your foot hits this, you look down, it says, in this house, Meredith Day and her family were deported to Auschwitz on such and such. So the government is trying, and I think they do a better job, but the people, there still is that strain that has to be shut down and hasn't yet.
Yeah.
Same in this country.
Right. And on that, I mean, and I watched the clip that you had sent me about this Holocaust survivor who's murdered, and things like Charlottesville, you know, swastikas being drawn or placed. I mean, these are turbulent times. And I think on the video that you showed me, maybe it was a New York Times article I looked up, it said that anti-Semitism is at its highest right now than it's been in, like, recent memory since the 1990s, perhaps?
That's probably true in Europe, but I think everyone here can relate, since this is a show on theology, that fear works, but it's never healthy. You know, when your love is greater than fear, then you're healthy. And so what I always try to do with Jewish people is to help them understand that while we must be vigilant about anti-Semitism in the world, let's face it, for the first time in 2,000 years, you can live with only Jews in the state of Israel. And you would rather live in Cordova, not Spain, but Tennessee, where 99.5% of Memphis and the Mid-South are Christian, pretty much. And they're wonderful. So you could understand that if you grew up in Germany, I, as a rabbi and a hospital chaplain, I remember going to St. Francis Hospital, and this one member of my congregation would not see the doctor, was afraid, slammed the door, cried, screamed, because he had memories of a concentration camp. I saw he had a number on his arm. So the trauma for someone like that is great. But for most of us, it's not true that if you scratch the skin of every Gentile, beneath every Gentile is an anti-Semite. And so, but still, if you have been picked on and persecuted, I really think it is a traumatic condition that you need to cope with and overcome. And I think most Jews have in this country. We take our freedoms for granted. I mean, we didn't come to America in chains as African Americans did. We came here to escape persecution in Eastern Europe. You know, Fiddler on the Roof may sound great. It's a great Broadway show coming to the Orpheum, but it was awful. You'd have drunk Cossacks come and rape the women and kill the men. And the beauty of Fiddler on the Roof was the humanity amidst the inhumanity. But still, when you came to this country, there were neighborhoods in Memphis Jews couldn't live in. There were signs that said, no niggers, no Jews, no dogs. That's what the signs said. We tried to put on a, we actually did a play with Playhouse on the Square some years ago, and that was the name of the play. So someone in the back of the audience, like here at a press conference, said, could we just say no blacks, no Jews, no dogs? And so it was Johnny Turner. She's the head of the NAACP who was with me. We were sponsoring the show. She said, what did the sign say? It was a white person in the back who wanted to change the sign. So we forget that anti-Semitism does exist in different forms. There's social anti-Semitism. There was economic anti-Semitism. Jews were not allowed to have certain professions. The old canard about Jews and money, you know, to Jew someone down was because the church would not let Jews be artists or teachers. They only allowed Jews to go into money lending. And then they accused Jews of cheating people. So I guess what I'm saying, Meredith, is there's a spectrum of anti-Semitism. What you read about in France is a lot different than ignorance bordering on deplorable hate, but not danger. And yet, the Anti-Defamation League, as you said, has found there. Once you let the genie of hate out of the bottle, people march with swastikas. So I hope we rise up as a country. You know that our better angels, no matter what our politics or faith, shuts this down, because if we've learned anything from history, is it can get out of control very fast. And it is in Europe and much of the Arab world now.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. And as you kind of mentioned before, or did mention before, you know, Christians have certainly played a large role in that. And I think even for myself, as I'm in discernment towards the priesthood and, you know, seminary grad, there are so many ways in which I see the church, the Christian church, contributing to that, whether it's our Holy Week liturgies, as you mentioned this, yeah, you know, the reading from John about the Jews, and, you know, this idea that you're right, like it has become this fictitious, like, narrative that the Jews killed Jesus, the Christian, you know? And, you know, also in just the ways that we understand and talk about the Bible. And so I see myself as hopefully a one day priest, that part of my job, my duty will be to help dismantle those theodicies. But I wonder, what is your sort of call for people of faith, and or Christians in particular? How can we best be allies to Jewish brothers and sisters?
It comes back to this day, Meredith, which is know the history, because bad history makes bad theology. So when I teach future ministers at the Memphis Theological Seminary, I do what one of my teachers, Amy Jill Levine, at Vanderbilt, yes, Divinity School, she wrote the greatest book on Jesus. It's called Jesus, the Misunderstood Jew. And what I do is I take out, this is my daughter, Julia, and I show these future ministers exactly the passages in Holy Week. I said, so here's the deal. This is my daughter, Julia. We love her. Inside our house, we called her a devil once. We did not mean for that to be broadcast and to be used against her. So when you read the Gospels or you read the New Testament, you're reading first century Judaism, second century at the latest. And so it was an in-house fight. It was the daughter Christianity breaking away from the mother Judaism. And when John says, you are children of the devil, he didn't mean for that to be a call on Good Friday to go out and kill Jews or beat up Jews. So I always tell ministers, when you read the New Testament to your congregation, please provide a context, or at the very least, don't say anything that would cause harm to this girl, because they're real lives. So the church laid the soil for the Holocaust, but the church never advocated genocide. It was to make Jews a witness of what happens when you don't accept Christ, the wandering Jew. Kind of like you, I know you've moved around a lot, you know. So
the wandering Meredith.
The wandering Meredith. The wandering right. The wandering day.
The wandering day. And with that, please join me in thanking Micah Greenstein for his presence with us tonight. The word remember, the Hebrew word zakar, appears in the Hebrew Bible 167 times. The word is most often used in the Torah and the Psalms, and it becomes a marker of sorts, pointing towards God holding up God's end of the bargain with the Israelites. God remembers Noah in the midst of the flood and the waters soon subside. God remembers Abraham, the promised father of a nation, and gives him a son. At the same time, God asks for remembrance in return. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And also remember how I brought you out of captivity into the land of milk and honey. As this word is used throughout the scriptures, it seems that the command is not one of apathetic passivity, but instead it is a calling towards a kind of liberal enterprise, one that implores each of God's children to work out of their remembrance, not just in mind, but in hands, lips, and feet. As we reflect and remember this Yom HaShoah, may we also call to mind the revolution, one led by fearless women and men who remembered their chosenness by the sacrifice of their own bodies. And as we ourselves consider all those in our world, the poor, forgotten, and oppressed, may we follow closely behind in the fullness of their wake. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to Ms. Lauren Hales and the entire staff of the Church Health Center for offering their space here at Crosstown Concourse. Our visual artist, Mr. Josh Colfer, our hospitality coordinators, Ms. Kathleen Hansen and Ms. Nikki Glenn, and our caterers, Mama Gaia. Of course, we also offer much gratitude to our guest this evening, Rabbi Micah Greenstein. Join us back here at Crosstown Concourse for our final episode of the season on May 10th. Visit us at 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology or on Instagram at Theology Live for updates about our episodes and events. If you have not already subscribed to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform, then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.